This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 13th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello, this is Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Christian Yeo. Coming up, in light of the call by the Arab League for a joint mission with the UN in Syria, we ask, can a peacekeeping force work when there's no peace to keep? And we'll be joined by Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to get a roundup of global affairs for the week ahead. Then we shift our gaze to New York, where we'll hear the latest from the designers at Fashion Week.
Getting ready to a show is like landing a plane on one of those runways that's in a mountain where you have to go like a million concentric circles and then finally you land. It doesn't end.
We'll also be heading to the Arctic to check in with our photo director, Poppy Shibamoto. We'll be asking her how to capture the perfect picture in minus 20 degrees. And after years of cities all over the world making their own interpretations of Chinatown, Shanghai has a go and creates Thames Town, a village that closely resembles London.
I feel a little bit annoyed personally that my master plan for the city has been warped by too much concentration on one little housing scheme.
All that, plus some great music as well, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. All that to come, but first let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Bombers have targeted staff at Israel's embassies in India and Georgia, wounding four people. A bomb went off in New Delhi, but a second device in Tbilisi was defused. Indian police say a bomb hit an embassy car and wounded a woman. A female employee of the Israeli embassy and three others were injured after bombers blew up a car outside the Israeli embassy in New Delhi. She hasn't been immediately identified and there's no word on her condition. Anjay Chadra, the senior official in India's Interior Ministry, says initial reports and eyewitness accounts indicated that some motorcycle riders had attached an object to the rear of the targeted vehicle.
Delhi police has reported that at about 3:20 p.m. today, an Innova car of Israeli embassy bearing number 109 CD35 caught fire near Aurangzeb Road crossing. Initial reports indicate that a foreign substance was attached to the rear of the vehicle. However, the exact cause of fire will be known after further investigation by Delhi police. The driver of the car, who is an Indian citizen, and one lady employee of Israeli embassy have sustained injuries. Two other civilians who were travelling in another car have also sustained minor injuries. Delhi police will be holding a separate briefing shortly. Thank you.
Meanwhile, the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Paul Hutchinson, confirmed that the Israeli embassy in Georgia had also been attacked. The United Nations has said that the Maldives should be left to find its own way forward with no external interference after the country's former president said he had been deposed by a coup d'etat last week. The former president, Mohamed Nasheed, said he was ousted in a coup on Tuesday, the 9th of February, by police and military officials on the archipelago, best known as a luxury beach holiday destination. Concluding a four-day visit to the Maldives prompted by Nasheed's accusations, the UN Assistant Secretary General for Political Affairs, Oscar Fernandez Taranco, said it was the citizens of the country that should ultimately determine their own destiny. Commentators and some politicians are openly speculating on how long Europe's single currency will survive in the face of the Greek debt crisis, as the French have been lining up in their hundreds to cash in their last French francs for euros. Clutching notes big and small, some in quantities worth several thousand euros, they waited patiently at the doors of the French central bank to exchange old money for new. Although the franc ceased becoming legal tender for everyday transactions in France several years ago, it is still possible to exchange them at the Bank of France for shiny new euros. The final deadline for this is this Friday, the 17th of February. Staying in Europe, the flower business has been booming today ahead of Valentine's Day tomorrow, the day when lovers around the world declare their love with a little help of flowers, chocolate and other romantic surprises. The auction hall in Aalsmeer, Holland is where the biggest flower auction happened, and it's about the size of 100 football fields, and flowers are shipped as far away as Kenya, Ethiopia, Israel and South America. Lex van Horsen is the spokesperson for Flora Holland, and he said that romantics were buying far more roses and tulips.
We do 50 till 60% more trade than a normal week. And for example, the rose, most popular flower during the Valentine period, of course, it's the flower of romance. There's a turnover for last week of 100 million, more than 100 million euros. And the tulip also, more than 100 million.
And those are the main stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, Jonathan. And we're covered in newspaper front pages here, aren't we?
Indeed.
Plenty to go through. The Australian ones are just coming in now.
Yes.
And what's caught your eye, firstly?
Well, a great story about Julia Gillard. You know, she's the Prime Minister of Australia, holding on to one seat or two seat majority in a coalition. And there's a great story in The Australian saying that she's been forced into damage control over claims her office prepared her speech accepting the prime ministership a fortnight before she ousted Kevin Rudd for the position.
Really?
Isn't that outrageous?
I mean, people do have speeches written for them, but I guess your acceptance speech for power, it's a bit preemptive as well before it's happened.
Well, she obviously put the knife in and then knew that she was going to do it. Mm. But this is outrageous that they're claiming that she knew in advance. Unbelievable. And this is not going to help her chances, I don't think, with the next election coming
up. No, I shouldn't think it would. I'm just looking at The Age, Australia's Age, and the big headline here of thousands more jobs doomed. The bank ANZ is the latest to announce more than 1,000 positions going mainly at its Melbourne headquarters. And also hot off the back of Qantas announcing job cuts and last week Toyota slashing its Australian workforces. So not good on the jobs market in Australia at the moment.
Not at all, no. Not even here, actually, in the UK, but there we go.
You've got one in Europe, haven't you, for us?
I've actually got a story in Europe. It's the story of two lovers, you could say, because you know Valentine's Day is tomorrow.
Yes, yes. Well, if you're waking up in Asia, it's Valentine's Day today.
Exactly, and the French, of course, are renowned for passion. Now, she's a former political journalist who fell in love with an eminent French politician during the 2007 election campaign. Any idea who I'm talking about?
Hollande.
Indeed, it's his present wife, Valérie Trévier, is preparing to become France's first lady with that politician, François Hollande, who's predicted to win the presidential vote in the spring. She's already been given an office at his campaign headquarters and has promised to accompany him on the trail so that we can see each other, she said. Asked how Mr. Hollande had changed since meeting her, she told French television, "I think he's liberated from a lot of things." And the last thing to say, her words might have irritated the former potential First Lady, Ségolène Royal. But she's been quite magnanimous, saying this year is a year of a new destiny, a new year of hope. It is the year of François Hollande's victory. So she isn't snubbed, despite the new situation.
I did gather that Hollande's wife is very popular. She ranked higher in a poll than Carla Bruni and Christine Lagarde.
Really?
It's phenomenal popularity. And just going back to the Australasian papers, the New Zealand Press has a great one if you're an insomniac of sorts. Chinese milk producers are hoping to develop a sleepy milk, which is obtained by cows at night when apparently they produce more sleep-inducing hormones. And they believe they can bottle that and sell it as a sleepy milk.
Well, so we were like that with these early shifts we have to do sometimes, don't
we
you think?
The opposite.
Well, we'll go to bed early with this stuff and hopefully fall asleep quickly. This is the thing. I sometimes find with early shifts I can't fall asleep like that.
You know what I mean? It's the time travelling that we do here.
Indeed.
Let's have a look at the weather now with Thomas Schaffernaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, especially the west of Europe, we're going to have much milder weather in the coming days. Across the UK and France, temperatures will reach 10 degrees. It'll also become less cold everywhere else in Europe, however, still cold enough for snow. And talking of snow, if you're travelling across Germany, Switzerland, Austria and Poland, a lot of snow by Wednesday, perhaps 10, 20 centimetres in some major cities. Even blizzards are possible. There may be some problems with airports, so the severely low temperatures may have gone, but the snow risk hasn't. Here's Tuesday's City Outlook, Valentine's Day. London, 8 degrees, a bit of sunshine. In Frankfurt, 0 and possibly some snow. Zurich, 0 Celsius, partly cloudy. In Moscow, minus 12 and cloudy. North America now. Currently, the central US is being blanketed by some snow. The East Coast looking fine for now, but Tuesday is looking cloudy and there's some rain on the way. Heading to Washington, D.C. and Boston, so a bit of a damp Valentine's Day here Here is Tuesday's City Outlook. New York City 6 Celsius and rain. Chicago 3 with some sun. In Miami 25 and sunny. And in San Francisco 15 degrees, mostly sunny skies. On to other world centres the next couple of days. In Japan, if you're in Hokkaido in the north, it'll be getting colder in the coming days. A mix of sun and snow showers in Sapporo, 0 degrees here. In Tokyo, a damp 10 degrees. In China and Hong Kong, mild and cloudy, 20 degrees, a little rain. But if you're in Malaysia and Kuala Lumpur, 30 degrees, sunshine and PM thunderstorms. That's all. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. Well, looking at the time, it's 10 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Christian Yeo. Now, Syria has categorically rejected an Arab League resolution calling for a peacekeeping mission to end the country's conflict, which has so far spanned 11 months. The joint Arab-UN operation has received the backing of the European Union, whilst Russia says it's looking at the plans and is seeking clarification on when the mission would start. It comes as the UN's human rights chief, Navi Pillay, warned that the Security Council's failure to pass a resolution on Syria spurred the government there to step up its assault on opposition groups. To discuss it further, I'm joined on the phone by Shashank Bangali, the national security editor for Mekaci Newspapers. Shashank, thank you for joining us. Firstly, it sounds like they want to send a peacekeeping force to a country in which there is no peace deal in place yet. What on earth? Where do we go from here? How does that come about?
Well, this is a problem, obviously. You don't want to have a peacekeeping force in a country where there isn't a peace to be kept. At the moment, the war is very much ongoing. In fact, it's by many measures escalating in Syria. Over the weekend, we had two large suicide attacks on security installations in Aleppo, the industrial capital, and we had the assassination of a general on Saturday in Damascus. And so there's increasing fears in Washington and other capitals of arms being sent in from sympathizers in Lebanon and Iraq and other neighboring countries. And so the conflict is certainly still ongoing and getting worse in many respects. Sending a peacekeeping force, even one with the backing of the UN, would be a very dangerous proposition indeed.
What feasibly can you expect to achieve in the circumstances that we have in Syria at the moment?
In terms of a peacekeeping force, well, what they could do, I suppose, one argument is that there has not been a foreign force that's been allowed to have a presence in the major cities to at least damp down some of the violence. However, you could get into a situation where you have the UN's experience in other countries, for example, in Darfur, in Sudan, where they took an African peacekeeping mission, gave it the backing of the UN. It's called rehadding. They were rehadded as a UN peacekeeping mission. And these monitors were essentially there to watch over a peace deal that had been dead on arrival since its signature in 2006. They've been stuck mostly inside their bases, not able to move around very much. They don't have legitimacy either in the eyes of the Sudanese government or in the eyes of the rebels. And so therefore you end up in a situation where peacekeepers are not really able to have the ability to move around. They aren't able to monitor the violence because of that lack of movement. And they lack legitimacy in the eyes of the warring parties. So they can't even be a means to end the hostilities either.
Let's look at the idea of joint missions historically, Shashank. This would be an Arab League joint mission with the UN. Do joint efforts with the UN work? Looking at the African Union coalition with the UN, as it were, you had experience with that. How did that work?
Well, in the case of Sudan, I'll just go back to Darfur very briefly. That was a case where the African Union actually, for the first time, launched its own peacekeeping mission, and they sent in African troops, and along with troops from other countries, primarily from Africa, from Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, South Africa, And then when that mission began to falter due to lack of funding and lack of support, lack of logistics, the UN basically took over the mandate and rehatted this peacekeeping mission, basically turned it into a UN mission. But it had the same, effectively the same boots on the ground, still African armies contributing soldiers, but sort of being run in a sense by the UN and having the legitimacy of the UN attached to it. The problem was that in the case of Darfur, while there was a willingness by African countries to send peacekeepers in, there was a lack of buy-in, as I said, from the warring parties in that case, and no real inclination by any side to respect the terms of the peace treaty, and therefore you had a situation where the UN peacekeeping force could do no better, really, than the African peacekeeping force that came before it.
With that in mind, you saying the UN eventually led the operation with Darfur, there would need to be a clear leader in this operation with Syria. Would it naturally be the UN, or could the Arab League lead the way?
Well, what we've seen, after the NATO operation in Libya, there's been tremendous reluctance from Western countries, even though that operation ended with the ouster of Gaddafi, which the Western powers and their Arab allies had called for. You have a tremendous reluctance on the part of UN member states to get involved in sort of a protracted intervention in Syria. The experience of Libya and how long that dragged on is still quite fresh. I doubt we'll see any real willingness of by Western countries to send troops in. If the Arab League decides to take the lead on this, and they've really been in the forefront of pushing on the Syria issue, you'll have a very difficult time because the Syrian conflict pits the minority Alawite clan of President Assad, which is a Shia group, against the majority Sunni Muslims in the country. And so you really run right up against that sectarian fault line that's really been ripped wide open in the past decade in the Middle East. And so any peacekeeping mission involving troops from Arab countries would be tremendously problematic. It would become a question of, which countries send troops. It would really sort of become a very thorny situation for Arab countries to send boots in. And then you're left with, well, who would actually send in the forces? And it's not clear anyone has the desire to do that right now.
Shashank, lastly, the words we've heard from Navi Pillay today and the ongoing talks with the UN General Assembly, will they make a difference at all, or are they just picking apart the carcass, as it were, and shouting out a lot of hot air? Will anything come of it?
Well, I think the UN, the Security Council is still looking, I believe, for ways to get an end to the fighting in Syria using all the various levers that the UN has. And the Human Rights Council is one way of putting pressure on the regime and the militants, the rebels, to end war crimes and to respect the laws of war in terms of civilian casualties and these kinds of conventions that the parties are have agreed to. So that would be one way of doing it. However, without buy-in from Russia and China, which are both very skeptical that this would amount to anything less than outside intervention in a civil conflict, you're not going to have a real consensus among the UN leadership and the UN Security Council to do anything going forward. And so I think you're left with probably just empty words and maybe an empty pledge to get the fighting to stop, but absolutely no desire, it seems, on the part of either the regime of President Assad or of the opposition forces to really bring that to an end. Both sides are now fighting for their very survival.
Shashank, thank you. That was Shashank Bengali, the National Security Editor for McClatchy Newspapers. Now, I'm joined by Monocle's Foreign Editor, Steve Bloomfield, to talk exactly this issue. Firstly, Steve, does the Arab League have a point in suggesting this plan?
It sort of has a point. It's trying to keep itself relevant, but it's got a problem in that, it can call for lots of things, but it doesn't have the firepower itself. When we looked at, go back to the situation in Libya, it was the Arab League that first called for a no-fly zone. but it didn't have the capacity to do it itself. It's now with Syria saying, well, we think something should be done, and perhaps there should be some sort of peacekeeping force, but we can't really do it ourselves. And in a sense, as Shashank said, you know, it would be very difficult. You know, who within the Arab League would send troops? You know, and if and as soon as you're suggesting sending Saudi troops to Syria, then you know that looks like to a lot of Syrians that will look like an invasion. So it's very tricky.
We're not likely to see the level of intervention that we saw in Libya, are we? Support for intervention, at least.
No,
we haven't so far.
No, and there's lots of different reasons for that. Firstly, the Syrian opposition are far more fractured than the Libyan opposition were.
Right.
So that's the first thing. Who is it we are actually supporting here? Secondly, it's logistically far, far harder. You know, Libya was, you know, difficult, but relatively straightforward in that it was, you know, essentially one long road with towns dotted along it and, you know, two major cities at either end. Syria is completely different, and we're not talking about having a no-fly zone. We're talking about, you know, intervening with boots on the ground, and that becomes incredibly difficult. And then the third thing is, you know, is there actually the appetite for that sort of intervention? And, you know, the UN has all, you know, everyone signed up to this idea of responsibility to protect, this idea that if, you know, a country is, government is killing its own people, we don't just stand back and say that's fine with us. But no one has quite worked out, you know, what is the moment where you say, okay, now we're going to step in and do something.
Well, that's exactly Russia's point. At what point do we step in? And it would be foolish to send UN peacekeepers into a country. It would be essentially lambs to the slaughter. And then we would be in a very different situation where you have people from all over the world seeking vengeance, perhaps, for the killing of their own people.
Well, I mean, Russia has two issues here. One is they don't like the idea of other countries interfering in one country's internal affairs. And so that for them is far more important than their relationship with Syria. It's about, you know, it's about the international community saying what's going on inside one country is so important, we need to step in. And Russia doesn't like that, just like China doesn't. You know, Russia wouldn't have liked that if the West had got involved in Chechnya. China certainly wouldn't like it if the West got involved in Tibet. So there's they have those ideological reasons as well for being wary of this.
The EU has supposedly backed this plan. What essentially does that mean? And how does the area within the EU garner support? Essentially, states within the EU will have different opinions on this.
They will. I mean, I think the European Union is trying to, along with the US, is trying to keep as much pressure on Assad as possible. They're aware that the failure to pass a resolution at the UN Security Council did send a signal to Assad that he could carry on as he was, that, you know, it wouldn't be possible to get international support. And we're now seeing, you know, this is the 10th day of the bombardment of Homs, and half the city's now been sealed off, I think, from both the east and the south, making it, you know, incredibly difficult for the Free Syria Army to get supplies, to help people there. So that has, yeah, that's certainly had an effect. And the EU is trying to keep the pressure on as much as they can. But, you know, no one has an answer for this.
Can you see momentum building at this stage? Will Russia's decision make a big difference in that?
I mean, it's momentum building towards what? I mean, I think, you know, as we were discussed before, you can't have a peacekeeping mission when there is no peace to keep. You can't have a situation now where, you know, I think it's got to a stage now where the West can't back down and say, OK, let's have a negotiated settlement. Pretty much everyone has called for Assad to go, so who do you negotiate with if you've said someone should go? We're in a sort of strange limbo, and it's going to take a while before it's clear, you know, exactly which direction things go in. And, you know, every day it goes on, things are getting worse for ordinary Syrian people.
But this plan, it seems, is a bit premature, you might say.
Yeah.
Steve, thank you very much. You'll be staying with us in the studio, won't you, to look at some of the other stories around the world. You'll be looking at the week ahead in global affairs. It's 24 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Now. Now, as I said just before we went to that break, it's time for our look ahead with the biggest stories of the week with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello again.
Here with us. We won't be talking about Syria, will we?
We'll
be talking the other things making news around the world.
Indeed. Well, I mean, Syria is going to be one of those stories, obviously, to keep an eye on for this week, as is obviously what's happening in Greece and the Eurozone. But there are two other things I wanted to briefly highlight. Well, I just take a sip of water there. The first is Barack Obama is announcing his last annual budget of this term. And he is, and what's interesting about this is that he's, you know, we're in election year. He's obviously, you know, he's got more than one eye on the November election.
Yeah.
And this is part of, he's using the budget as part of helping to create dividing lines between himself and the Republicans so that the election doesn't just become a referendum on his 4 years, which could, you know, be tricky for him because some people, you know, people on the left will say they're disappointed that he didn't do more on healthcare or didn't do more on
helping the poor.
On helping the poor, yeah. Exactly. And then, you know, lots of independents will be slightly unhappy because he promised, you know, he promised big and he delivered little, some would say. So he is trying to shape it as, look, there are two options. And he's made it very clear that...
I'm the middle ground man.
Yeah, and that I'm the guy that will, you know, essentially tax the rich and help the rest of you.
Robin Hood.
So, yeah, or Robin Hood who sort of, you know, taxes only the very, very rich and,
yeah,
and distributes to, you know, the moderately all right as well as well as the poor. So what he is calling for is the raising of $1.5 trillion over 10 years from the wealthiest taxpayers. So that will be including closing some corporate tax breaks, mainly oil and gas companies. And then he's also, you know, looking at making sure that, you know, taxes for those, you know, less well off can be lowered slightly. Now, is that actually going to happen?
Exactly. This is the question that you have to ask. Is it just strategic electioneering? It's timely, this
There's a
speech.
Little bit of it. And I think it's, you know, I mean, it's going to be difficult because he has to get this through, you know, the House of Representatives, which is where the Republicans have a majority, and they're not likely to give many favours in election year. Frankly, they haven't been up for giving any favours in any
throughout,
year, let alone right now. So, no, possibly lots of this won't actually happen. But what it does do is say, look, this is what I'm for, and this is what I'm trying to do. So, in that respect, certainly when you're up against, you know, a likely candidate like Mitt Romney, who has, okay, these have been slightly taken out of context, but says things like, you know, I'm not bothered about the very poor. Yeah, I think certainly helps him. So they're being quite canny, the White House here, and using that rather well, those budget proposals.
And time for one other on your radar before we go
okay,
to the news.
Okay, one more. Francois Hollande, the French socialist presidential candidate.
Yes.
Who you were mentioning earlier.
Doing quite well.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that the left, since the global financial crisis, has been sort of struggling for a narrative. The left across Europe sort of assumed that, there's a recession. Everyone will switch towards us because they realised that, you know, capitalism was terrible.
Is it working? Yeah.
Yeah, hasn't. Yeah. And that strategy has failed abysmally. I think only like 4 out of the 27 governments in the EU are centre-left. Francois Hollande has a real chance to win in April. And if he does, it will be on a manifesto that is very left of centre. And what's interesting, he's meeting this week with his counterparts in Italy and Germany. And you are starting to get a sense that the centre-left across Europe, maybe not the UK just yet, but across the rest of Europe, is starting to talk to each other, is starting to develop some sort of narrative about how to deal with the financial crisis. They've been helped, obviously, by the fact that austerity hasn't been a huge success, and that is quite tightly linked to the right of centre. So it looks like they're sort of getting their act together.
They're all forming strategic alliances, as it were. Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, thank you as always. Now you're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, it's time to get the news from around the world with Jonathan Weekly.
Thanks very much indeed. Bombers have targeted staff at Israel's embassies in India and Georgia, wounding four people. A bomb went off in New Delhi, but a second device in Tbilisi was defused. A female employee of the Israeli embassy and three others were injured after bombers blew up a car outside the Israeli embassy in New Delhi. The United Nations has said that the Maldives should be left to find its own way forward with no external interference after the country's former president said he'd been deposed by a coup d'etat last week. Concluding a four-day visit to the Maldives prompted by Nasheed's accusations, the UN Assistant Secretary General for Political Affairs, Oscar Fernandez Taranco, said it was the citizens of the country that should ultimately determine their own destiny. New Zealand health officials admitted overreacting after boarding a plane at Auckland Airport after dozens of passengers on a flight from Tokyo displayed flu-like symptoms. Medical staff boarded the plane when it landed, suspecting 73 Japanese homestay students on board of carrying an unknown strain of influenza. Parts of one of Europe's busiest airports have been evacuated after a bomb threat was received. A Dutch military police spokesman told Reuters the two main international terminals at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam had been evacuated. While commentators and some politicians are openly speculating on how long Europe's single currency will survive in the face of the Greek debt crisis, the French have been busy lining up in their hundreds to cash in on their last French francs, 4 euros. Although the franc ceased being legal tender for everyday transactions in France several years ago, it's still possible to exchange them at the Bank of France for shiny new euros. The final deadline is this Friday. And finally, staying in Europe, the flower business has been blooming and booming today in Holland, ahead of Valentine's Day tomorrow. At the world's biggest flower auction, located outside Amsterdam, traders were snapping up 50 to 60% more flowers than during any other week of the year, roses and tulips in particular for romantic lovers. And those are the latest stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan, for that blooming, marvellous news bulletin there. Welcome back to Midori House. New York Fashion Week kicked off last Thursday alongside the big women's shows such as Diane van Furstenberg, Oscar de la Renta, Ralph Lauren and Marc Jacobs. The number of men's shows and presentations are growing. New York editor Aisha Spears caught up with two of New York's most well-known menswear designers. First off, Michael Bastian, formerly men's fashion director at Bergdorf Goodman, will this week be offering up collections under his eponymous label as well as for American heritage brand Gant. Aisha met with him at his design studio over the weekend to talk this season and the current state of men's fashion in the US. She started by asking how he was preparing for his upcoming show.
We just finished casting and fitting, and it's kind of a rolling process. I like to compare getting ready to a show is like landing a plane on one of those runways that's in a mountain where you have to go like a million concentric circles and then finally you land. It doesn't end. It's not like the plane just goes down, coast on the tarmac. No, it's circling and circling and circling. And, you know, we've done this enough till, you know, to realize that at the last minute, some models are going to drop out and someone's going to get sick. And so you have redundancy plans. It's just
plan A, plan B, plan C, and plan D.
Exactly. If it can go wrong, expect it to go wrong and just kind of roll with it at a certain point.
What's your inspiration been for this collection, and what are you looking forward to everyone looking at?
I'm really excited by this season. We were most inspired by this idea of the extra man. And by that, what I mean is those guys that every hostess keeps in their back pocket because, you know they will be well-dressed, keep the ball in the air, charming, funny, have a good dirty joke. You know, basically the guy that everyone wants to sit next to at a dinner party. And at least in New York, the big hostesses are always married ladies, and they always seem to have a lot of single girlfriends, and you always have to have that group of guys in your back pocket that you can call at a minute's notice. So it's a funny idea, and it kind of sprung out of this article we found in the New York Times from 1974 called New York's Most Wanted, and it just basically called out these are the 30 guys that the hostesses rely on in New York. And there were guys on the list like Bill Blass and Albert Hadley and a lot of guys that I had never heard of but must have been kind of fancy and wonderful at the time. And, you know, it was just a funny, sweet idea because this season we also wanted to register dressing up a bit more. You know, I feel that whole moment of neo-grunge and heritage is just feeling so old and tired and sloppy right now that I want everyone to have neatly combed hair, you know, be as neat as a pin, shiny shoes, lots of cashmere socks. You know, that's kind of what feels fresh right now, dressing up again.
And that's something which we've seen as a, you know, not even a trend, but a serious part of the market here in the US, the increased focus on tailoring. And the Italian brands that we were talking to in Milan last month were saying that one of the biggest growth markets they're seeing is here in the US, which they weren't really expecting. They thought it would actually take a dip. Why do you think this is? What's going on? Why is the American man kind of investing more in well-tailored pieces?
It's an interesting kind of macro phenomenon that's happening. There's this whole generation of men who never were forced to wear a suit to work. And they are now approaching tailored clothing and the suit in a whole different way. You know, it's not a have to wear, it's a want to wear. And they're almost approaching it as just another fashion option. But they don't want that baggy, awful, mushroom-colored suit their dad wore to work. They want something that's slim and sexy and very designer in a way. You know, they expect all those great details that they're used to in designer clothing. So that's the first, you know, game changer. The second is the guys that maybe did have to wear a suit took that nice long break with dress casual for at least 10, 15 years and are now, it looks fresh again. But like the younger guys, they also want something a little different, a little trimmer. So that's what I think is driving this.
And what does that mean for you as an American designer? How do you feel like you need to represent that? Because obviously a lot of guys are looking to the tailoring houses in Europe, but also there's a pride in supporting American designers. How do you answer their kind of call for this, these kind of new needs in menswear?
Well, it is a little tricky because America's kind of known as the place to go for casual clothes. And here we are proposing a different way to dress up. But I think if you see the kind of things we're about to put down the runway and put them side by side with an Italian house, it kind of becomes very obvious. I always just like to think that the American gift is looking a little bit undone, a little unpredictable. Even if he spent, you know, 2 hours getting ready in the morning, when he leaves the door, it looks like he spent no time getting dressed. And that contrasts with the typical European way of dressing in that, you know, we all have seen a very dressed up Italian guy that's almost bulletproof. It's almost intimidating. It's so perfect. And I think even when an American guy is as dressed up as he can be, there's still that smile. There's still that unexpected accessory. There's that little chink in his armor that allows emotion to get in a little easier, you know? And I think that's our gift. And it's hopefully what we're weaving into this, into these looks this season.
That was Michael Bastian. Later on, Aisha spoke quickly to Simon Spurr backstage before his show started last night. British-born but New York-based, Spurr's been showcasing tailored menswear for the last few seasons.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm calm, relaxed. It's very well organised back here. It's the same team, so there's a lot of familiar faces and ready for a good show.
It's quite a big production. So, I mean, we've talked about before the fact that you know, very much is an American label. as an American man. How do you still feel like that? I mean, as a British designer, that's something we're always interested in with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm based here, so it's an American brand, but it's always been more of a European or British aesthetic, for sure. And, you know, you can take the boy out of England, but you can't take England out of the boy. So my reference points are very British.
And then we've seen a huge bounce in the economy in the States, in the market here in the States for tailored menswear, be it from Italian brands, be it from American brands. How are you riding that, seeing as you kind of came in before that bounce happened, you preempted the trend in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are like shifting into suiting, and you know, obviously we're at one of the forefront of like the younger brands doing it. We're trying to capitalize it on as much as we can. You know, we're eventually going to start like made to measure and some custom suiting, stuff like that. But it's slow and steady right now for us. We're still, you know, we've got to walk before we can run.
And outside of the US, where are you looking? Are there any markets which are surprising you?
We're doing really well in Korea. We have limited distribution, but sell through there is really good, and even like celebrity presence over there is picking up. So I think like Korea and Asia, really in general, like the growth markets for every brand.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of kind of getting over there and making them aware.
And finally, the question which I'm sure everyone lining up behind me is going to ask you: tell me quickly about the season and what you're excited about and your inspirations.
Inspiration was loosely based on a sense or a feeling I got from Robert Frank's pictures of London in the early 50s. These very distinguished gentlemen in like London fog and the elegance that they carried with them. So obviously translate that into a modern sensibility. That compounded with kind of, you know, still the Savile Row references, still the Tommy Nutter kind of like playful juxtaposition of fabrics and things like that.
That was Monocle's New York editor speaking with menswear designer Simon Spur. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Just looking at the time, it's 43 minutes past the hour here in London. Time for a song, I think. This is Pressure by Quadron. Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. That was Pressure by Quadron. Now it's time to check in with Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, who's currently in Innery, in the heart of the Norwegian Lapland. It's an important and natural stopping place on the way to the North Cape. Poppy joins us on the line now. Poppy, are you keeping warm?
Yes, I am.
How are you doing?
I'm in the town of Innery, which is actually a Finland part. I just drove back from Kalastjok, which is Norway side, and above Arctic Circle. So it is very cold. It's minus 17, and I think it's getting colder now.
So you've made good progress so far. You've already been through Norway then?
Yes, I came back from there already.
So describe your surroundings. Where are you at the moment?
I am actually in a hotel called Hotel Inari, surprisingly. And there's only a couple of hotels in this town, so I'm quite happy that I've got a warm place to sleep tonight. Decor isn't great, but I can't complain.
And what about your outside surroundings? What's it like to shoot there?
It's if we drive a little bit farther, we get to see reindeers. We saw moose as well, and we ate one of those as well.
Wow.
And
what was that like to eat? What did that taste like?
It's quite gamey, but it's not so strong as lamb or goat. It's quite nice, actually.
They're quite fatty.
It's tough. I don't think so, but Sophie Grove, our correspondent, we had really nice reindeer soup, I think. It was reindeer on the bone with potatoes. Really hearty soup lunchtime. That was very nice.
That will put some meat on your bones, I should think. What sort of temperatures have you got there at the moment?
It's minus 17.
Right, wow.
So,
cold. Is that proving difficult for you to take pictures? Is your shutter stopping or is everything going to plan?
I think it's all right. We've actually got a professional Swedish photographer called Felix Odell. And he's been taking pictures with very old, large format camera and on a plate. And he's been doing okay. I think it actually helps not being digital photography. So, yeah. I mean, battery goes flat as soon as we go outside. So phone battery goes and digital camera battery goes very quickly.
I heard you had some technical problems. You're having to charge things constantly. That must be annoying. So what are you shooting then for the magazine?
We are doing a story on the family and some themes on the parliament, but not a lot I can tell you right now because it will be top secret and coming out next month.
So we have to wait until next month to see all these beautiful pictures.
Exactly. But it will be a photo essay. Everything we shot today and yesterday looks fantastic. And the Sami people are wearing their own traditional clothes, which cost about €2,000 for one whole set. So it was, very beautiful.
Is it all work and no play? Are you having some fun in the snow while you're there?
Yeah, I'm trying. I don't really like dogs, and I saw a lot of sort of husky-looking dogs. I'm a bit scared to go outside. But in this hotel, there's like a jukebox, and then somehow, I am Japanese, but somehow a lot of Japanese tourists are here. So I might have a chat with them.
That'd be good. Have some fun with them. Now, I have to ask about your infamous shoes. You skimped on the old shoes when you went out there, didn't you? How much did your shoes cost to take you in these conditions?
Well, I asked my fashion director, like, how much these shoes costed, and he told me it looks like £3. But actually, it was £7.99, down from £30.
£7.99?
So it was on sale, but I negotiated down a bit.
And how have they fared? Have they done?
It's all right. It's waterproof still. I feel a bit parts coming off, but it'll do.
There you go, it'll do. No need to spend more than £7.99. You heard it from Poppy herself. Poppy, stay warm and all the best on your ongoing journeys. Thank you ever so much. That was Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto. You're listening to Midori House. Now, the Chinese are famous for their canny knockoffs, from the computer handbags to automobiles. So how hard would it be for them to copy an entire town? On the outskirts of Shanghai is perhaps one of the most ambitious knockoffs ever produced in China, an English country village called Thames Town. Monocle's Shanghai correspondent Justin Bergman made a trip out to the town to see if he could find any fish and chips.
Getting to Thames Town is not easy. You must ride for more than an hour to the end of Line 9 on Shanghai's metro, and then take a taxi. When you step foot inside the English village, however, you feel like you've traveled much farther. The narrow roads are cobblestone and have names like Church Street and High Street. There are red telephone booths, zebra crossings, Tudor-style buildings, and yes, a statue of Winston Churchill. The question you ask yourself is, how did this place get here? Anthony Mackay, an architect and urban planner with the British architecture firm Atkins, has the answer. He's the chief designer and master planner of the Songjiang New Town, the Shanghai suburb where Thamestown is located. But he wants to make something very clear right from the start.
I really want to say, put a preface in, though, about my involvement in this, because I'm not the designer of Thamestown, and I don't like it. So, you know, you start from there. In 2001, I was asked by Atkins to design a competition project in Songjiang, which is the name of this city. It's not actually called Thamestown, as I said before. It's a whole new city. And so I came up here and spent 3.5 months designing that, and we won the competition. It was an international competition with French, German, Japanese, and so other nations competing. Part of the brief for the town was to produce an English quarter. And my approach was to base it on English town planning principles, not to base it on style, not to base it on slavish reproduction of English architecture. Because you can never actually do it anyway. It's impossible to reproduce historic buildings with all the craftsmanship and all the expertise that goes into it. The city started to develop, and develop very quickly. And then about 2 years later, or a year later, I was back in London and was asked to produce an urban design master plan for a housing scheme, this English quarter, but on a different site to the original one, so to the west of the main park, which eventually became Thamestown. After that, Atkins was employed by the developers to build that, to design it in detail and to build it. And I was not involved in that, but what happened then was that the designers here in Shanghai decided to go to England, photograph buildings, collect a lot of information, and then copy them and put them together according to that structure plan. And this is what they did. I feel a little bit annoyed personally that my master plan for the city has been warped by too much concentration on one little housing scheme, which just happens to be a novelty. It's almost like a theme park, you know, an English theme park.
5 years after Thamestown was completed, it does feel more like a theme park than an actual community. On the day I visited, there were plenty of newlyweds in bright red and purple outfits posing for photos in front of the English church on the village green. Around the corner, a film crew was preparing to shoot a commercial for a Volkswagen minivan. The director said he chose Thamestown for the project because it has quiet residential streets, not for the faux English charm.
Although the place is full of tourists and it's kind of a novelty attraction and people go and have their wedding photographs taken, etc., etc., there and so on, the place is not fully occupied. None of the shops really have worked. A lot of the houses are unoccupied, so it's not a very successful place in terms of community planning. Whereas the rest of the city, which has developed around it, is fully occupied, nearly fully occupied, very vibrant, and although it may look very different, it mostly looks modern, it's actually much more lively in essence, really, than Thamestown is, and much more of a genuine place for Chinese people.
The architecture is obviously the big draw for tourists, many of whom may never get the chance to visit an English town, let alone take their wedding photographs there. But Mackay says if you look closely, the village doesn't look like anything you'd actually find in England.
The buildings are really a pastiche of English architecture. They don't, if you look at them as an English person walking around there, I find it quite disturbing, really, because none of the buildings are truly English looking. And there's an odd junction or conjunction between Cotswold architecture, Georgian architecture, town architecture, village architecture, and it's all clagged together in a very strange mixture, which is very artificial and very surreal.
Given that half the houses in Thames Town are unoccupied, the question remains why the developers would have wanted a community like this. Mackay says in the future, he hopes developers will give more thought to the needs of everyday residents.
It's very difficult to answer your question about why now, in the 21st century, when we should be designing for the younger generations, you know, for the next generations, really, not for the past, why we want to build fake imitation European or whatever villages or townships in China. It's a mystery to me, a total mystery. I can never get a clear answer from the Chinese developers to whom I asked this question. So this is an ongoing question, ongoing saga, and I hope that in the next 10 years or so that people start to forget about this and get on with creating real Chinese living cities, you know, for the modern generation.
That was Monocle's Shanghai correspondent Justin Bergman. Well, we're out of time for this Monday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 hours London time, the Monocle Daily will be kicking off the day in Asia with Steve Bloomfield and Hugo McDonald. They'll be discussing Zambia's victory in last night's Africa Nations Cup. But next on Monocle 24 is the Culture Show with Robert Bound, so stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. Thanks for listening.